Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Lots to pack in today's show. We'll look back at the crazy tests at Lords last week, as well as the first Ashes test that starts at Edgbaston later this week. We've also got interviews with two bowlers who enjoy bowling at Lords in today's pod, Glenn McGrath and Tim Murta. I'm Yaz Rana, and today I'm joined by the Wisden Cricket Monthly duo of Joe Hardman and Phil Walker. How are you two guys doing?
Hello, Yaz.
Yeah, very afternoon, good, thank you.
Proper Wisden show today. Let's start with that extraordinary test match at Lords. England bowled out for 85 on the first morning. Tim Murta bowling one of the all-time great spells at the home of cricket, 5 for 13. Ireland post 207, a handy 121 lead before Jack Leach opening the batting in the role of night watchman, scored 92. Before England collapsed the lead, Ireland needing 182 for their first ever test win. And then Ireland obviously bowled out for 38 on a crazy third morning. I mean, Phil, where do we even start with that test?
Good question. It's the extremes of cricket again. At lunchtime on day one, Ireland were in dreamland, and on lunchtime on day three, they were faced with the horrible reality of having posted comfortably the lowest Test match innings score in history at Lords. Despite that, they would have strolled away from Lords feeling hopefully reasonably chipper about the performance that they stumped up there. Tim Murta, obviously, on the first morning, was everything that English batsmen would have had nightmares about. And at lunch, there was the sense that something magical, really magical, had already happened. Whatever was going to follow from there on, something already quite marvellous had happened. 5 for 13, I think it was, Murta. And interestingly, the bookie still had England overwhelming favourites, even having basically given up an innings first up. And in the end, you know, experience told. Broad and Wokes did the business in the fourth innings. But it was joyous and in many ways bizarre. You mentioned Jack Leach. Jack Leach was man of the match.
He scored 9.5% of his first class runs in his whole career in that innings.
And well, that sums it up. It was a bizarre 3 days of cricket, and it was a shame that Ireland didn't win it. You know, and I speak as an England supporter, it's a shame Ireland didn't win it. It would have been marvellous. As it is now, we just park that, put that down to a peculiar fever dream for a few days before the main event. But how glorious would it have been if Ireland did it? I think Niall O'Brien said on the morning of day three, strap yourselves in for what could be the greatest of all Irish sporting stories. And although there's an element of hyperbole to that, it's not far off. It's a shame from a neutral's point of view that they couldn't pull it off, but what a peculiar, bizarre 3 days cricket.
From an English point of view, the collapse on day two was arguably more worrying than the collapse on day one. Tim Murta was bowling so well, that kind of thing can just happen in cricket. Whereas on day two, Jack Leach played with reassuring simplicity, block the balls on the stumps, leave good balls and hit the bad ones. That was quite worrying, that collapse on day two, right?
Yeah, until Roy missed a straight one playing a loose shot that he was obviously absolutely furious about afterwards. It looked like him and Leach could just bat forever, which is a weird thing in itself when you're talking about Jack Leach batting forever. But yeah, and I see where you're coming from. I think as much as there were some shocking passages of play in that match that we perhaps didn't see coming, they didn't reveal any new shocks about this England team particularly. We went in knowing that England have a very flaky top order. We went in knowing that Moeen's really badly out of form with the bat. We know that Bairstow's having a real horror run with the bat. These things are already there. So whilst they were shown up in an Ireland game, it wasn't like a shock horror. We also remembered that we have a fantastic group of seamers that are going to be very hard to pick from. And it kind of encapsulates the weirdness of their game that almost it sits on its own and doesn't necessarily inform anything else, in that Leach, the player of the match, has been dropped. There's a good chance that Wokes might not feature at Edgbaston potentially if Archer is considered fit. So almost that game has just been forgotten. It was a kind of outlier of a warm-up game that has had little bearing on much at all, apart from possibly if Joe Root ends up batting number three. Perhaps that shot.
Is there a rumour that he might?
There's a definite rumour there is. The suggestions and some of the things that Bayliss has been saying over the last couple of days, that he said, I made no secret of the fact that I'd like Roy to bat three. To repeat that now, a couple of days out from the Ashes, leads me to think that it's at very least being talked about seriously. I'm not quite. The suggestion is that means that Roy drops down to four. I'm not quite sure what that solves really. If you have Denley and Burns as your openers, that is concerningly weak to me.
Did you see Nasser Hussain's prospective 11?
Opener A and opener B.
Opener A and opener B, with Root at three and Roy at four. So if Bayliss as I understand it, Bayliss seems to be alluding to the same lineup, right?
Although I think they will be picking two openers.
Yeah, sure, sure. But I can see the logic of that. I mean, as I've said to you before, Joe, Roy as an opening batsman seems like a push. Roy as a number three, you feel like he has a puncher's chance. Roy at four becomes more and more persuasive.
I can see both sides of the argument. What I can't see is how that's changed over the course of a one match against Ireland. If he was good enough to open against Ireland with the assumption that he would continue to do that job in the Ashes, I don't see what's changed over that period of time to cause such alarm.
Well, one thing that has changed very quickly is Rory Burns and how people are viewing him. Last summer, he was one of the players of the English summer. And it wasn't necessarily the runs or lack of runs that he scored. It was how he looked when he was batting.
Yeah, look, it was agonising. He made 6 and 6 from 24 and 25 balls, respectively, with no boundaries in there. He was out, caught behind both occasions, one to Murta, one to Rankin. The first one, he was trying to hit mid-on to a ball that was seaming across him, going down the slope. And the second one, he was defending pointlessly to extra cover. It's a sporting travesty when you see a player so higgledy-piggledy, so scrambled by the sudden absence of form, and how that dismantles your movements, dismantles your game bit by bit. And it's a cruel slice of luck on Rory Burns. 5,000 run seasons in a row, 1,300 and plenty last year as a championship winning captain. There was not one person following English cricket who didn't overwhelmingly say he has to open the batting for England and we have to give him a proper run. He played 6 test matches over the winter, made 2 good 50s, I thought. Made a tricky 50 at Palakkelly in a game that England won, and a good 80-odd at Barbados in the first test before missing a straight one, a tick before lunch against the part-time off-spinner. You know, 16 away from a good 100 against Gabriel, Roach and Holder. He's batted twice now in England, faced 51 deliveries, and he's yesterday's man. Talking again of Nasser, Bumble also picked his team. Atherton also picked his team. None of them had Burns in their team.
Vincent Milan were featuring quite a lot. Well, that was quite interesting.
He's obviously hanging on by his fingertips. I had an inkling, as I said to you, Yaz, last Friday, that he might, after the nature of Lords, he might have been dropped. I think looking at where his technique is at the moment and knowing what's going to come, knowing how he's going to get bombed by that cohort of quicks, I had a sense that England's selectors might have just overlooked him for this first test match. As it is, I'm glad, from a sense of fairness, that they've gone with him for this test.
There was an argument potentially to drop him without entirely discarding him, in the sense that if he's in such poor form, is it beneficial to even to him to put him into a test series against the Australian pace attack and to send him back to county cricket and try and get some runs? Now, the obvious issue, he wouldn't get much of a chance to get county runs in between, which is the issue we constantly have with the fixture schedule.
It's quite frustrating because some people will dismiss him as a player, oh, well, he's got runs in county cricket, he couldn't do it in test cricket. That's not true. He's a good player and he's just out of nick full stop. There's nothing to do with him playing test cricket and unable to do that. The way Rory Burns batted at Lord's last week was not how Rory Burns batted. His technique is unconventional at the best of times, but it's not that. And it's quite interesting because we're here at the Oval and he was working with Neil Stewart, today. And I don't know, it's quite interesting seeing how he's gone back to Surrey coach. And obviously, he's scoring all these runs at Warwickshire. He's been using Gary Palmer's services, the man who helped Alistair Cook towards the end of his career.
And helped me through the latter stages of my career
famously.
We'll come to Gary Palmer in just a minute. Yeah, so we were watching this morning, Burns with the Stewart brothers. So Alec feeding and Neil, who is Rory Burns' mentor since the age of 8, standing on the adjoining net watching from the side as if he's got silly point to Burns, watching studiously as he goes about
it. He couldn't have been physically closer.
No, he couldn't. And Burns has said to me before, whenever he has a slight issue with anything technically, he always goes back to Neil Stewart. He thinks he's the best batting coach he's ever come across. It's no surprise that he was out there on Monday morning before the biggest week of his professional life. As I say, look, I'm really glad that they've given him a go here. He's hanging on by his fingertips, unfortunately. But cricket is a peculiar game. And if he can eke out a good 40 somehow, you know, a little bit of luck as well. Luck plays its part, right? He didn't nick one last year. I was looking through his scores of late. The last last four innings at the Oval, he's nicked off early on 3 out of 4. That kind of happens when you're out of form. He played a miss once at Lords, and he nicked 2. You know, another day you play a miss half a dozen times, you have a bit of luck, maybe a catch goes down and you're away. By no means should we be writing him off, because he's been the preeminent opening batsman for half a decade in county cricket.
But this is the issue with picking him now, that if he does fail twice, maybe 4 times against Australia, then perhaps he does get written off. Perhaps that's just a line struck through his name, like there have been with probably Jennings or Lyth in the past. And I think that would be a real shame, because
Is he in your team, Joe?
He was in my team, yeah.
For this upcoming game?
He is, yeah. I mean, I have to say, without a huge amount of confidence,
yeah, sure.
And I was tempted to drop Burns and play Sam Curran, just because I think Sam Curran might score as many runs as Burns if you've got that extra bowler. But mm-hmm. I think if you do that, too many players end up batting a position too high.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I just think it's just a messy way to start a big test series, to have a kind of ill-matched side.
Yeah.
And I think you've just got to give an opener a proper go, and I think it probably should be Burns.
He didn't look out of his depth in the winter, did he? He didn't nail down his place, sure, but there were moments where he looked to be moving in sync with test match cricket, and he looked like he had a chance.
He got out in weird ways as well, didn't he?
He was caught down the leg side twice.
Run himself.
Run out once, yeah.
The concerning thing for Burns, I think, is as well that there are a lot of people who, you're absolutely right, when he got picked, everyone thought it was his turn. But prior to that, there had been a lot of people saying, well, he's scoring runs in county cricket, but I don't think his technique's up to that. And now people are using this poor run of form as justification for those thoughts previously.
Well, it's funny how quickly a county story that is one to celebrate, you know, a self-made cricketer who gets to the top of the county game by his own means and his own methodology, it's funny how quickly that can be flipped on its head. You know, now he's in certain quarters being held up as some kind of exemplar of that which is sort of iffy and questionable about county cricket, that there's a unique and sort of esoteric puzzle to scoring runs in English cricket that doesn't really apply in test cricket pretty much anywhere else. And I feel sorry for him that he's kind of been put into that bracket. Mm. You know, he follows Alistair Cook, who was no one's idea of a flawless technique, you know, and yet found a way to do it. My heart goes out to him. I have to say, I like him as a bloke. I've interviewed him a few times. He's the kind of cricketer that you root for, because, as I say, he's not overwhelmed with talent, but he's found a way to get it done. He's deserved his shot, and it would be a shame after 10 innings or so, when he hasn't disgraced himself, for him to have been stuck on the cart.
I want to ask you a bit more about Gary Palmer, your personal batting coach.
Let's do it.
Because to a non-cricket fan, it is interesting that a guy who's in the England team goes back to his club side to get the coaching when he's out of form. There's a little quote from Alistair Cook on working with Gary Palmer. He said, "For the first time in my career, I've had a batting coach who is purely just technical. In one way, like a golfer has a swing coach, yeah. Gary is that swing coach."
Right. So
aren't there more Gary Palmers, basically?
So that would have been from four or five years ago, probably now, when Cook went and sought out this renowned, slightly eccentric, very, very likable bloke, Gary Palmer, a former Somerset cricketer, who didn't quite cut it for that long at Somerset, and has since become a specialist batting coach with a specialist methodology, or philosophy, if you like. And in short, it's essentially, he advocates batsmen squaring up more to the bowler. So squaring up the shoulders, squaring up the hips, squaring up the feet. So you are facing the bowler more square on than the traditional side-on approach, as we're taught when we're kids and so on. More and more, as you watch top-end cricketers, you see that this is the way that they play. You watch Steve Smith play. He's a very good example. Interestingly, just as an aside, Ben Folkes, when he went on that Ashes tour, spent a lot of time watching Steve Smith, as everybody
spent
did.
Spent a lot of time watching Steve
and
Smith.
Came back for the following summer with a Smithian technique, which has echoes of Gary Palmer's approach. What Palmer did with Cook was get him to face up more squarely to the bowler, which in turn then accesses the V. So as it's the old cliche with Cook, oh, if he's hitting mid-on, then it's a good day for Cook, right? Well, Palmer was specifically working on that. He's also worked with other England players who he once told me not to divulge publicly, but some of these players he's now working with officially, and Dominic Sibley, I think George DeBell from Cricket Info mentioned that Sibley has been working with Gary Palmer as well. Gary Palmer has a kind of a makeshift net behind a shopping centre in Oxfordshire. I've been there myself. He, I had a morning working with him. And it's a very, very interesting and quite persuasive approach, I think. The idea being with certain players, they get closed off through the leg side and they end up falling over. They play around their front pad. Well, Palmer's approach is to clear that front pad away. Now, there's swings and roundabouts with this. You can say, okay, well, you're not accessing the cover drive as much because your front foot is more pointing towards mid-on than mid-off, right? So there's various different back and forth arguments with all of this, but it has quite a lot of currency. And he was employed by the ECB, Gary Palmer was, a couple of years ago to work with some of the Lions players and to put forward this idea. I think there is a lot in it, actually.
So is it right that now they brought Marcus Trzaskowski into the setup as a batting consultant for this course, this series? Now, Trzaskowski's international career stands there in its own right, as his county career does. But he's not a coach at this point. Should they be going to someone like Trzaskowski, or should they be going to someone like Gary Palmer, who is a specialist batting coach and has obviously had great results with some very well-established players?
Why do you think that there aren't more specialist batting coaches like Gary Palmer? I mean, Cook said it himself, and he's not been used that much.
Imagine, and this is kind of me guessing, that Gary Palmer, you said earlier, Phil, that he's so single-minded about his craft.
He's evangelical about this theory.
That it's quite difficult to go for just the odd tweak here or there. I mean, Cook went as a kind of sort of remodelling of his game. So if a player is very comfortable with their game but just wants something to be looked at, then you could find yourself in quite a difficult scenario where too much is trying to be changed on the eve of a test match. So I guess in that sense, it makes sense that players go and seek him out when they feel in enough trouble that it needs to be fixed. Whereas do you want someone like that there all the time, potentially? Because a lot of the international players really just want reassurance.
Yeah.
They just want to be told that everything they're doing is working well for them. Now, obviously, when an issue crops up, you need to fix it. But perhaps Palmer doesn't fit quite into that slot as neatly as someone like Trzaskowski does.
You've also got to earn a crust as well. And someone like Gary Palmer has no real public profile within cricket, and there are very few who are in effect freelance independent batting or bowling or fielding coaches who can make ends meet. You know, I mean, this is the ongoing challenge really for a lot of coaches who are very good but are outside the system, and until you get on the ECB's payroll, you're always going to be struggling a little bit to hold it together.
England have named their squad for the first test match. 10 of the 11 that played at Lords are in it. Player of the match, Jack Leach, is the only one to miss out. And it's plus Joffre Archer, Ben Stokes, Josh Butler and James Anderson, who also make the team. England have some serious issues with their batting. This is a list of their England's test batting averages since the start of 2018. Folks top with 41.5, Butler 40.78, Root 37.3, Wokes 33, Curran 31, Stokes 28, Cook 28, Bairstow 26, Jennings 25, Stoneman 24, Denley 24, Burns 22, Leach 21, Rashid 20, Darren Millan 19, and Moeen Ali 16. Traditionally, in recent years, England's lower order has got them out of jail quite a few times.
Mm.
In that first test match, there's a chance that there's Moeen at 8 with Bairstow at 7 and no Chris Wokes and no Sam Curran in the side. That's a very... You know, that doesn't fill you with as much confidence as England batting lines have had in recent years.
No, and that is more of a concern. We've almost got used to having no top three, and you just keep thinking the middle order will get you out of trouble. And that has continued to be the thinking, but actually it's just not true. Those numbers that you give there, Moeen averaging 16. Bairstow, what do you say?
26.
Yeah, I mean, those aren't figures that are going to get anyone out of trouble.
Since Bairstow,
Stokes 28.
Yeah,
as well. I'd be amazed if Stokes doesn't average higher than that in this series.
Exactly. I think Stokes has in the last few months has looked a totally different player in all formats.
An argument to put him up the order, I think.
Yeah,
well,
absolutely. Bairstow, basically, ever since he started opening in ODI cricket, averages 27 or 28, which is nearly 3 years of Test cricket where a player of his talent's averaging under 30.
And to repeatedly be bowled by straight balls. I mean, people have been talking about moving him up the order. There's even a suggestion that him and Roy might open the batting in a test match. I think we're all getting a bit overexcited during the World Cup there. And that, I mean, that just can't happen, can it? He's actually lucky to have his place in this side, really. If Folks was fit, he's got a side strain at the moment, hasn't he, I think. If Folks was fit, you could very much argue that he should come in for Bairstow, bat at seven, and he's the better wicketkeeper.
Bairstow's made 5 noughts in his last 7 innings in England, or is it matches in England?
I know he's got 7 noughts out of his last 27 innings, full stop.
Right,
which is a lot.
Yeah, it's the form of a number 7 and nothing more than that, really.
Is it even?
Well, indeed, yeah. Indeed. Yeah, so is Bairstow looking to bat seven? Is that the mood around this
pre-match? I think that's right with Stokes and Butler to come back into the side. Bairstow drops from five to seven.
Yeah.
As you say, Bairstow batting at five with those stats, that's just not on really at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So seven's a more natural position. But yeah, I mean, those figures are just so alarming. There is a sense that we certainly got in the first innings against Ireland. He goes out there so pumped up at the moment that you feel like someone needs to try and calm him down. I know there's the Owen Morgan said you need to kind of harness that energy, and you saw that when he scored that brilliant 100 in the World Cup when he came in with some criticism. But at the moment, it feels like a weakness in Test cricket that he's perhaps got to get into a different zone and just see out that first couple of overs, because those number of ducks are telling.
Early today, Joe had the opportunity to speak to Ireland's hero in the Lords Test match, Tim Murtagh.
Looking back at that first innings, that incredible first morning when you took 5 for 13 and skittled England for 85, did you approach it any differently with it being a test match, or was it just like another day at the office opening the bowling at a ground that you know so very well?
I guess in one way it was lucky that sort of surroundings were obviously, as you say, very familiar, and tried in my sort of best to treat it as a county game almost, and I'm bowling at Jason Roy and Rory Burns for Surrey for Middlesex basically, but obviously it's a bit more special than that, and I felt a bit more nervous, I guess, than I normally would before a game. But I think that kind of seemed to go quite quickly. I kind of settled into it in the first over, and kind of those kind of nerves went. So yeah, I mean, as much as I could, I was trying to treat it as another game, but obviously it was, you know, the biggest game that I've played in my career, so it was important that we kind of soaked up the occasion as well and sort of enjoyed it as much as we could.
There are a few guys in your team who haven't played much first class cricket, let alone test cricket.
Yeah.
Did you see it as your responsibility to kind of settle them down, or even kind of lighten the mood a little bit in the lead up to obviously what was such a big occasion for Irish cricket?
Yeah, definitely. I think the days leading up to it, I kind of tried to get round, especially the bowlers, just speak about the slope at Lords. It obviously is quite unusual to sort of play on a ground like that, and a lot of the guys hadn't played there before, so I saw that as kind of part of my role as a senior player in the team, just to try and get the lads as relaxed as possible and sort of as familiar with the surroundings as they could be before the game started. So yeah, I mean, you can say as much as you want, but I guess it's up to the individuals to kind of take it on board, and I thought they did really well, the bowlers especially. You know, Mark Adair bowled, I thought, excellently throughout the whole game, and Boyd Rankin and Stuart Thompson as well. So yeah, it was I guess that was part of my role as a senior player.
And what about the mood and the aftermath of that defeat, because obviously there was a huge amount to be very proud of in that game, but then the final day obviously didn't go as you'd have hoped. Were there some very down cricketers in that dressing room afterwards?
Yeah, there was. It was quite a weird kind of feeling, because everyone was so sort of high after the first 2 days. You know, I thought won pretty much 2 days out of three, and we've had one bad session on the third morning, but that happens against quality bowlers and a quality team, and you know, they blew us away that last morning. And I kind of said at the end, don't be too disappointed, and you know, that kind of spell of bowling would probably have blown away a lot better teams than us. So I think after the initial kind of disappointment, there was a lot to be happy about. We had all the families in the dressing room, and they kind of helped lighten the mood, I guess, and sort of made us aware of what a special occasion it was for them as well. So it's obviously disappointing to get blown over like that, but you know, those conditions were, you know, almost unplayable, sort of with the quality of seam bowling that England have.
Is it right that you have a dinner with Ed Joyce to thank for this chance to play international cricket?
Yeah, pretty much. It was just spoken about over, I think, 2011, something like that, about 8 years ago now. He kind of just asked about my heritage and the name Murtagh being Irish, and I kind of said, well, my granddad was born in Ireland, and he kind of put me in touch with the performance director of Cricket Ireland, who was quite keen to sort of get me qualified and get all my documents in order that I needed to do to be able to play. So I'm thankful to him, thankful to my granddad, I guess, for being born in Dublin, to give me that opportunity as well. So that's how that all came about.
You're 38 in a couple of days, I believe.
I am, yes. Right?
Yeah. You still seem to be bowling as well as you've ever done. That's at least the impression from seeing you the other week and over the last couple of seasons. What more are you hoping to achieve of Ireland? Have you still got a few more years of international and county cricket in you?
No, well, I have to choose one basically at the end of this summer week, as Irish players can't play domestically as local players in England now. So it's kind of, it's getting to the stage where we have to choose one or the other, and I still haven't sort of made my mind up. There's discussions to be had with both sides still. So,
right.
Unfortunately, that kind of loophole's being shut or whatever, so we can't continue playing in county cricket as local players. So I'm going to have to make quite a tough decision at the end of the summer, really, just sort of which way I want to keep going.
Okay, on England, just wanted to get your view. We seem to be perpetually locked in debate about the openers, and many have been tried and none have quite been able to nail that spot. You'd have bowled at pretty much all of them over the years, I'd imagine. Are you able to put your finger on why so many have fallen by the wayside? Are you seeing clues in county cricket that the rest of us aren't picking up?
I guess a lot of people want to bat in the middle order now. Whether there's an actual shortage of openers, I'm not entirely sure, but it is. Look, in England, it's tough work facing the new ball. The wicket's been better this year, but the last couple of years have been sort of tricky for those guys, especially at the top. So, and it's difficult. Anyone who's done well, all the guys who've been tried have done well in domestic cricket. Yeah. So it's not as if they didn't have any kind of form behind them when they started playing. It's just obviously another step up, which they're finding tough, especially in this country. So, you're going to have to ask someone who knows a bit more about batting than me.
We enjoyed your innings at Lord's.
Yeah, there for a good time, not a long time. As I said, it's tricky, and a number of guys have been tried, and I guess they've just got to try and stick with a couple of guys and give them a good solid run. But that's always difficult in Test cricket. Your kind of techniques get pulled apart, don't they, in one game, and you have one bad Test match and you're under pressure. So that's the nature of international sport, I guess, not just cricket. That scrutiny and all the analysis that comes with it is always going to be there. So as a young opener in England, there's no better time, I guess, to be sticking your hand up and wanting to have a go. So it is tough though.
Who have you found trickiest to bowl at? Either guys who've been tried or potentially are still waiting for their chance?
I'm probably a bit biased, but Sam Robson for me technically is as good as any of those guys out there. I've played a while with Middlesex. He's scored 200s quite recently in the Championship. I mean, Dom Sibley's obviously scored a lot of runs and can't be far away from getting an opportunity at some point. He's technically pretty good as well. I mean, some of the other guys, Zach Crawley, I've never played against, so I wouldn't be able to tell you about him. But I mean, they're all at a similar level in that, they're hard work to bowl out in county cricket. They're all good players. But I guess that kind of pressure and that spotlight stepping up a level is tough to kind of manufacture.
So, Joe, Ireland came so close to Murta Bowl brilliantly, but I thought what was quite encouraging was that Mark Adair, one of the young'uns making his debut, was crucial in both of those England collapses.
I thought he bowled really nicely. Yeah, I heard about a few years ago at Warwickshire coming through as a really exciting young player. I think he's
let him go, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
In order for him to play as well.
Yeah, and all Ireland players are going to become overseas players at the end of the season.
Well, that's interesting. So
it's
Irish players
with
will,
him, isn't it?
Irish players will count as overseas players from next year, but he's Northern Irish. And I'm no legal expert, and I'm sure neither of you are either, but I'm not sure if you can legally bar a UK citizen from working in the UK on the basis of where they're from in the UK. I could be talking nonsense there.
That's a very good point, and well beyond us on
this Northern
podcast.
Irish.
Still why we're here, yes.
Yeah. Well, I really liked him anyway. He bowled,
bowled
well, good pace, swings it both ways, and it was... I mean,
Looked like a bowler as well, shaped like a bowler, and bowls that kind of heavy ball. Just, sorry, in brackets, I wanted to just mention Ollie Stone, who I was very impressed with.
Go for it.
I'm tempted, if Jofra Archer isn't fully fit for Edgbaston, and it's better that they hold him back for Lords and onwards, then I'm mightily tempted to play Ollie Stone at Edgbaston. I fear a one-paced attack if England go in, say, with Stokes, Wokes, Anderson, Broad. I'd be very tempted to play Ollie Stone. I thought his spell on day one, after 15 wickets had already gone down, I thought it was excellent. And he cleaned up Balburnie, who was playing nicely for 50-odd with a Jaffa, and two wickets in that spell, I think, and he bowled sharp. He hit Porterfield, a sickening blow on the helmet. He offers something a bit different, he looks, if he's fit, like he can do a job at Test cricket, I think.
I don't disagree with that. I can't reconcile picking him for the first Ashes Test ahead of Broad or Wokes, effectively, isn't it? So who would you...
I said this to you in the office. I said I'd pick Stone over Wokes, and then he took... Then Wokes took 6 for 17 and three wickets without conceding a run straight afterwards.
Yeah.
But for that logic, I think if Archer isn't fit, I mean, England were desperate to find a fast bowler for ages. Two came along at the same time. They're both injured now. So, I don't know.
The one-paced attack thing is, it is hard to argue against, but it does feel like that classic start of a new Test series. Perhaps get a bit overexcited and want to tinker with too many things. And Broad's taken, what, 444 Test wickets. Wokes averages, I think, 22 in home tests in England. To drop one of those for a bloke who has spent more time injured than fit in his career so far, hasn't really bowled much this year, but can bowl pretty quick, seems a risky one, and one that you might think kind of 2 hours into a Test match. Not really sure about that. A bit like when England dropped Broad for the first Test in the Caribbean. Different circumstances because for Sam Curran, they weren't going for extra pace. They just got the conditions wrong there. But I'd still really struggle to drop. Actually, I was listening to Alistair Cook. I was mulling this over as well, listening to Alistair Cook on TMS. And he was just like, well, yeah, of course you pick Stuart Broad for the first Ashes Test. How can you not pick that experience? Yeah. And the way in which he said it, I was like, well, yeah, perhaps we're silly to even be debating this.
Yeah, and he will almost certainly play on Thursday.
Ahead of Wokes anyway, I think. Do you think Broad and Anderson play?
I think a lot of it hinges on Archer. You know, if Archer is not deemed to be fit enough, then I think Broad plays alongside Wokes.
If Archer's fit?
I think if Archer is out, definitely fit, and they believe he can do 5 days, then Wokes probably misses out, yeah.
Yeah, harsh.
Very harsh.
In my team... I'm overlooking Broad, and we picked it for the website today.
I bottled it and just claimed that Archer's not fully fit because it makes it easier to pick the side. And then it's sort of a kind of a playoff between Broad and Wokes for the second Test, really, because Archer, when he's fit, has to play.
Yeah.
Australia have named their Ashes squad. Just one spinner in it. No Joe Burns. Siddle returns. No Alex Carey. And Michael Nisa, a more than handy all-rounder, made the cut.
And Cameron Bancroft's back.
Cameron Bancroft is back.
Saw a headline in Australia putting the band
back together.
Very,
very
good.
Nice.
Nice.
I spoke to Glenn McGraw earlier today about his thoughts on the Ashes. Glenn was speaking.
First name terms, are you?
Yeah. Right, okay. Me and Glennie. Glenn is working with online trading broker Think Markets to encourage more young people to get into sport through the Think 2020 initiative. This is what he had to say.
So, Glenn, you're famous for your pre-Ashes predictions. What are you going for this time round?
Yeah, no, I'd occasionally make a prediction, and so I've thought this time I'm going to sit on the fence a little bit and just see what happens in that first Test. I think if the Australians can get off to a great start and win that first Test, I'll be coming back out and saying 5-0, definitely, but I'm going to wait until the end of that first Test.
Australia have got a plethora of seam bowling options, yep. Pattinson, Cummins, Stark, Hazelwood and Peter Siddle as well. If you were picking the team, which three would you pick for Edgbaston?
Yeah, it's going to be tough. Pat Cummins is just bowling incredibly well. I think he's number one at the moment, and so he'll definitely play. Hazelwood, they'll be keen to get him back in playing. And I think a lot of it will depend on what the pitch is. If it's doing plenty, they want guys that can hit good areas. Mitchell Stark, on his day, if he's swinging the ball, is as good as anyone. But some days, the radar's not quite switched in. And James Pattinson's just been playing or bowling incredibly well, and just the attitude he brings and that aggression, you want him playing. So it's a tough choice. If it's a flat deck, I think Mitchell Stark will play. If it's a bit of a green deck, then maybe Mitchell Stark will miss out and I'll play Pattinson.
With Siddle's experience of playing in England, the way Tim Murtagh bowled against England at Lords last week, would you be tempted to try and get Siddle in the team if it's a green pitch?
You want to play everyone, don't you? So, especially when the ball's moving around. And Sid's has got so much experience, can just land the ball where he wants. And if it's just seaming around and the juke balls with that big seam, is brilliant to bowl with. Someone like him could be pretty effective just on that length. It's tough to score. one mistake and you're out, and that's what Test cricket's about. So, yeah, we'll wait and see what the pitch is doing, and yeah, there's a lot of options.
You had a great record bowling in England. As an Australian coming from Australia where the conditions are slightly different, what do you have to do as a bowler to adjust to English conditions?
Yeah, it's a slightly different length you have to bowl. You have to get a little bit fuller. In Australia, just really hit that pitch and get that bounce, but you need to use the seam movement and the movement off the pitch here in England. So you've got to get a little bit fuller. And I think back to that 97 series, we played the first test at Edgbaston. We bowled pretty poorly, the wrong length. England won by 9 wickets. The next day, we came off our long run for 2 hours out in the middle. And Jeff Marsh, our coach at the time, got us to bowl that right length, get it fuller. And that had a big impact. We went to Lords, played well, and then went on to win that series. So, yeah, we learned from the first game, but hopefully, a few of the Australian bowlers have been here before. Hopefully they can adapt from previous experience and not need one test to get underway.
On England, England also have a lot of options in the seam bowling department. A lot of guys have done really well, particularly in English conditions. You think that Anderson and Broadplay and Archer as well, would those be the three that you pick?
Well, they'll be keen to play Archer. There's been a lot spoken about him. I think he's a quality young bowler. He's got a massive future in front of him. I like the way he goes about it. He's nice and relaxed running in. He can generate really good pace, good control and good bounce. So, yeah, there's a lot to like about him. We saw him in the Big Bash back in Australia and, I was impressed. So I think he's got a big future in front of him. But to adapt from one-day cricket to Test cricket, it takes a little while and you need that experience, and hopefully guys like Jimmy and Brodie can help him adapt a little bit quicker. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing both bowling attacks this series.
On Archer, some have compared him to you, actually, the way in which he bowls very stump to stump. What have you made of Archer's start to his career, and do you see any of him in you?
Any of me in him?
Yeah, that way around.
But I would like to have bowled at his pace and done it as easy. So, but yeah, I think he's got a massive future in front of him, and he's got everything he needs to be able to perform at Test cricket. And you've got a couple of senior bowlers there I mentioned before. He's quality.
And one final question: England look likely to be opening with Jason Roy. How do you think he's going to go? And do you think he's got the technique that that will thrive in Test cricket?
Yeah, that's going to be one of the challenges for England. I think in one-day cricket he knows his game so well, but if he goes out and approaches it the same way in Test cricket, I think he might struggle a bit. He is a shot maker, but you've got to be able to adapt your game. And Warner did it. Warner started off one-day cricket and adapted his game to Test cricket. So for Jason Roy, he needs to do that. That's going to be one of the big battles this series, how Australia's bowling attack bowls to their top order. If they get on top of them early, get Joe Root in a lot earlier than he wants to, then that can have a big impact too.
So Joe, which bowlers did you pick for Australia? They've got Pattinson, Cummins, Stark, Hazelwood and Peter Siddle as well. Which three would you go for?
Oh God, it's really tough, isn't it? I would certainly pick Cummins and Pattinson. So then it's between Hazelwood and Stark. As McGrath said, I'd just look at the conditions. I'd be tempted... I think I'd go with Stark, but it's really harsh on Hazelwood, particularly when the narrative was that he missed out on the World Cup so that he could be
saving up the Ashes.
Why didn't he play in the World Cup?
No idea.
It's weird.
No idea. It'd be hilarious if he then doesn't play in the Ashes because they're arresting him for the Ashes.
The reality, with the fixtures coming thick and fast, they're all going to play. They're not going to be able to do what they did in the Ashes down under, where they just played those four bowlers throughout and they took all the wickets.
I don't think the tests are going to last that long. They're only bowling 20 overs a test.
That is very possibly true for the reasons we've just discussed.
Yeah.
I think Bancroft coming back in, he's now going to play, right?
I think so.
He will? I mean, there's an argument. He batted brilliantly in that Cape Town test, I thought.
Yeah, made 80 odd, yeah.
He was their leading run scorer in that series. He scored loads of runs in the Sheffield Shield. He's done well for Durham.
It's an argument he just slots in. I mean, I've read some pieces saying, well, Australia have done this because they had to kind of reconcile with the past of the ball tampering. And until they had... I just think he was the man in possession. Fair enough, Joe Burns came in and scored some runs. Marcus Harris scored some runs. But against weaker sides, Bancroft knows English conditions well now. Joe Burns, by contrast, has played quite a bit of county cricket and never done well. I can see that as a sensible move. And it certainly makes for interesting viewing, isn't it?
Yeah, and at the moment... Wade's in form, Bancroft's in form, Head's in form, Labuschagne's in form. We've got Steve Smith, David Warner. Phil, how do you see the series going?
I think Australia will win. I think Australia will win 3-2, maybe 4-1. I think their pace attack is terrifying. I think they have four, of which you pick three, and Nathan Lyon is a brilliant off-spin bowler. They have those two big lads coming back. Steve Smith's a machine. David Warner thrives on being some kind of panto villain.
He's not got the best record in England, though.
Not got the best record, but he's played well invariably, I think, in England. He was brilliant at Durham in the game that they lost back in 2013. He made a brilliant 80-odd in the second innings and looked like he was going to win that game for them. But you're right. But I don't think that's because he's technically questionable, really. I think Warner will have his day. It's going to be a bowler's series. And my fear with England is that in bowling conditions, they fall over just too regularly. They've fallen over four times in a session now in the last year and a half or something. Crazy.
England's bowlers are very, very good, though. Joe, do you agree with that?
They are. I boringly agree with Phil's prediction. I put a little bit of money on 4-1. I think 3-2 is perhaps more likely. Just the odds at 4-1 look quite tempting. Yeah, I think when we talked about the last Ashes series, like, well, England have definitely got a much stronger middle order. And I think that's probably still true, but then just not performing that well. And I think in a low-scoring series, I just back Smith and Warner to score more big runs than I do England's big batsmen. And I think you're right, the pace attacks are both very, very strong. But I still think Australia's is a bit stronger, certainly a bit more intimidating. It's a really big series for Moeen Ali as well. I mean, we've had some great weather. You'd think that the spin is going to come into it. Moeen just doesn't look like a confident cricketer at the moment. Now, he's bowled very well in England in test matches for a while now. Is he going to be able to recapture that when his place is really under threat as well?
We have said it about him, though, haven't we, a few times, going into big series. And you're right, he's obviously such a mercurial cricketer, but he could easily just go to Edgbaston and just take six or seven for, you know, and then he's sort of back.
And really, they'll take him on as well, which always gives him a chance. Warner will come at him as he did last time.
Ben Garner's writing an article as we speak on Moeen, and he did quite a lot of research into this. Moeen is like no other all-rounder who's ever played. And only once in Moeen's test career has he averaged more than 30 with a bat in a series and less than 30 with the ball. He's either good at one of them.
Yeah.
Or the other.
Yeah.
And right now, he's really bad with a bat, but he's also been...
He's averaging about 23 with the ball, though, isn't he?
In that period where he averages 16 with the bat.
12 months?
More than.
And so he's not really an all-rounder. He's just one thing or the other.
He's a batsman or a bowler, not both. So I don't think his position is under threat that much. I think he's bowling so well and has done. He's been England's leading wicket taker in the last two series that England have played in as well. I think he'll be fine. I think it's just a massive series for England's big guns. It's Root, Stokes,
Root,
Butler.
Right, Root. Finally. It's a huge series for Joe Root. Joe Root has yet to fully establish himself as the captain of the Test team, which is not to say that he won't. But by mid-September, he could be completely settled and comfortable in the job. Or Joss Butler could be captain of England by the end of September, genuinely. There was always a sense with Root, when they gave him the captaincy, there was no one else standing for it, granted. But he's so precious. He's such a champion, supreme batsman, that there was that fear that traditionally captains have to accept that they take a trade-off for the glory. They maybe lose one or two digits on their average. With Joe, because he's so great as a batsman, there was that concern. And there's yet to be overwhelming evidence that he's able to manage those two requirements. It was a hiding to nothing in Australia last time out with Stokes not there. Of course it was. I thought he conducted himself great. But England lost, of course, abroad, you know, in the West Indies. They very nearly lost against Ireland. They lost against Pakistan at Lords last year as well. He doesn't seem yet to have the... you know, the sort of sharpness and the creativity and the authority that you get with the really good test captains. That said, this could be his defining summer, but it could work both ways. I would not be surprised if before the year is out, Joss Butler is the captain of the England test team. I would not be surprised.
Ben Stokes has just been named as the vice captain. Why do you think that was done?
I think because Stokes is the perfect vice captain. I think PR wise, it's good. I think on a kind of ethical level, I think it's fair. But I also think that Butler stands more chance of being the long-term test captain than Stokes does. I think Stokes will always be the ideal vice-captain, provided he goes to bed at 1:30 rather than 2:00.
I think that's all probably fair. I think the issue comes about if Morgan decides to step down as one-day captain.
Which I really,
from seeing the interview he did with Rob Key on Sky Sports, I really thought he didn't give too much away, but it felt like he was leaning that way. I mean, he was saying, look, I need to know that I'm still going to be here in 4 years and that I justify my place in the team and that it's right for my family. He was giving a lot of reasons to not necessarily continue.
Right.
So then if Butler comes in, I mean, you can't give someone the whole lot now. I know Williamson does it for New Zealand, but he's kind of freakish in that sense.
And also,
Kohli is absolutely freakish in that sense.
And they don't play as much cricket as England do. And India rest Kohli a fair bit as well.
Could I also add as well, just on this, before people start sort of piling in on the comments about Root, there's no disgrace in not having a 50 test match career as a captain. There's been many, many great, great cricketers who have taken it on. It's not quite worked. The alchemy of the moment's not quite there.
Sachin,
but many, many, many others, really. And there's no guarantee that just because Root was given the armband that he had to make a success of it, and he would be a failure if they were to agree pragmatically at some point, okay, you know, you've had 20 test matches, it hasn't quite worked, get back to being the best player of a generation.
And this can come from him as well. Ask himself, does he actually enjoy this job? Does he relish this job? I remember Graham Swan, who admittedly says a lot of things, but has shared a dressing room with Joe Root, saying he's just not the right choice as captain. That's nothing against him as a person. In some ways, it's to his credit. You don't want to diminish the things that he's really good at. And it's still too early to say either way. And I agree with Phil, this summer will go a long way to telling us either way whether this is something that should be continued for a long period of time or whether we just put it down to he's not the best person to lead the side, primarily because of what he can offer us elsewhere.
Very quickly, I think this is Australia's best chance of winning in England since 2005, but I still think England will win it. The same problems existed last year against India and England somehow won that 4-1. I think this
how did that happen? Yeah. back, I was trying to remember it.
England had exactly the same problems, and now
Sam
they've got,
Curran,
and now they've got
of picked
and Kohli scored loads of runs,
and now England have Archer. And I think Stokes is. I hope and think Stokes is going to have one hell of a series. I think he's going to average 50 with a bat, and he's going to be the one who scored the runs that Curran basically did last time. And Butler, I think, is a better player than he was. He's played more Test cricket. And I just can't see Root being out of nick for that long as well. So,
all right, I feel a lot better now. Yes.
England to win 3-2.
3-2.
Yeah, they win it. Here
also, it's interesting. We're going for we've all said 3-2 with a bit of 4-1 possibly thrown.
Well, they're not drawing
as though as though it's going to be a really exciting close four Ashes series, which we don't see too many of them at all. And that would be great, whichever way it goes. Obviously, I want England to win. You want a really, particularly after what we've had already this summer, you want an Ashes series that like actually gets you involved in the game-by-game scenario rather than just being a series of one-sided contests, which is what it's largely been.
Yeah, absolutely. Even when it was 3-2 here in, 2015, it was a weird series because England would kind of won it by Trent Bridge and the last test was
the Australia won, they thrashed England.
Yeah, what we need is a classic. We need a classic game. We need a game where it goes down the last at the end of day four.
What was the last good Ashes test match?
Well, this is it. It's a genuinely tricky question.
Cardiff 2015, that was a good test. I mean, England won by about 100, but had it not dropped Root, that game could have easily gone the other way. 2013.
Trent Bridge.
Yeah, Durham, again, that was a good test match that year.
Durham was a good game there. Yeah,
so Australia were favourites there. Score one. Yeah.
So basically, in England, you get the odd one.
But this is it. It's a long time.
Three in the last decade.
Yeah.
Earlier, I spoke to Betfair cricket correspondent Ed Hawkins, who had a couple of tips for you ahead of the Ashes. Ed, what are your tips going into the Edgbaston test?
Well, I think because the two teams are quite well matched. I think they're both weak. They've both got decent bowling attacks, but the batting is flaky, to say the least, whether you're wearing green and gold or three lions.
Yeah.
And that's going to make for a very, very tight series. And if batsmen are struggling to post big scores, and we've got results wickets at these five Ashes test venues, I can't really see a draw taking place. So for your correct series score markets, siding with England at 3-2, About 7.6 is a good value bet, and keeping Australia on your side as well for a 3-2 win makes sense as well, and you can get around about 9.2, that's 8-1 basically in old money, and those are two solid interests for the series going ahead.
Cool. Any other tips?
I think there's some bit of value knocking around on top Australia series wicket taker. Pat Cummins has usurped Mitchell Starc as favourite on that market, as people have wised up to Cummins' superior strike rate. There's been a bit of doubt about whether Stark's actually going to make it for the whole series because of James Pattinson's late run into contention. So Pat Cummins, because he's a tack leader and he's going to play all five barring injury, you can still get about 3.3 on the Betfair exchange for him to be top Australia series wicket taker. And his numbers basically in the last 2 years, he's superior to everybody in that team. So he's really, really solid, and he can get things to move off the seam and he'll attack with the ball. So Pat Cummins is a really solid bet.
In my eyes, he's the best pace bowler in the world. It seems like a very solid bet. Ed, thanks so much for speaking to us. Chat to you, Ed, soon.
Cheers, bye.
Phil, what was your moment of the week?
Well, I was in Chelmsford on Friday to see my first game of the season, actually, in the England women's Ashes. Obviously, other things have been, you know, front and centre, unfortunately, during the World Cup and so on. So this was actually my first game that I've seen live, my first experience of this latest iteration of the Australia side. I'm no encyclopedia, in truth, on women's cricket from what I've seen myself, but I've never seen with my own eyes a cricket team, a female cricket team, as complete as this one. Just in the field, they are phenomenal, I thought. And Mark Robinson alluded to the gulf in athleticism and physicality between the two teams. I think he alluded to that maybe after the ODIs or possibly after the
test match.
After the test match. Well, I'm glad he's recognised that, and I'm glad he's open and honest about that. But it's staring one in the face when you see the two sides go up against one another in the field. Watch Ashley Gardner field at deep cover. It's a thing of beauty. You know, she attacks it, hurls it, gathers and hurls it all in one motion, and it's flat and hard over the stumps. You see Beth Mooney field at long on as well. And I haven't even mentioned Lanning, who is a phenomenon.
What was that like to watch?
It was funny actually. It was a really nice atmosphere, right? And despite the blowout nature of the game, that didn't really matter too much, I don't think. I was watching it as a punter, really, and I was with a group of friends, of which there's two teenage girls who are just getting into cricket. One of them plays cricket in Suffolk, and she's just getting going, and she's fascinated by the game. And we were watching Lanning together, and she was transfixed by her. And I said, she said to me, who are the best players? And I said, well, Lanning is probably the finest, most complete female batsman ever. So watch her, and watch her closely, and watch what she does. Watch how it works on her own. She plays the game on her own pace, really. And such was her authority that England's bowlers wilted, like they do like you'd see in a club game when somebody so much head and shoulders above everybody else emerges. They just have to take guard, and already they're 50 not out. And she has that kind of aura. You don't make 133 not out in a 20-over game unless you're a very, very special cricketer. But there was something even deeper going on, I thought, really.
And then in the second T20I, England got up to 120, had Australia 35 for three. And then Perry and Lanning just made it look so easy, scoring it well over on the ball without taking any risk.
Yeah.
Perry has been the player of the match in four out of the six Ashes matches.
Right.
In Lanning and Perry, it's quite hard to compete with any team that have a Lanning or a Perry in him.
Yeah, they are iconic cricketers, and we talked about generations to come when it comes to women's cricket.
And England star players, just Perry and Lanning, I think, are better than any players that England have. But England do have star players of their own who just haven't really turned up in this series. Like Heather Knight's had a really, really difficult run with the bat. Sarah Taylor obviously is not being available to play in the T20s for the continued mental health issues.
But she was also really struggling on the pitch.
She was, and she was, and Shrubsall, well, obviously the two things.
Shrubsall bowled as badly as I've ever seen her bowl.
She got dropped.
So she didn't play on Sunday.
Which is kind of unthinkable, really, to be dropping Shrubsall.
But based on how she's played, totally fair.
Yeah, absolutely.
She went for 50 off her three overs.
This is what I'm saying, though. There was like a collective surrender amongst the bowling side, bowling attack against the force of Lanning, who Ben Gardner just told me is now 333 not out in T20s against England. They last got her out in March 3 years ago. So she's 333 not out off 203 balls. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's beyond Bradman-esque.
And Perry is the first cricketer, male or female, to have scored 1,000 T20I runs and taken 100 T20I wickets. But there's the gap in class, but some odd tactical decisions from Heather Knight as well. Why opening the bowling with George Elwis when you're defending 120 was just an odd move to make? Like, you've got someone like Sophie Eccleston at your disposal. Get her in quickly. And I know England took quick wickets later on, but
The medium paces are absolute fodder in this form of the game on these tracks. Definitely the only way that they could have gone was to take pace off the ball constantly. Eccleston is class. Laura Marsh bowled pretty well on Friday in a broadly thankless task, but it was quite stark. There'll be a tendency to just pile in on the English setup, and people want their pound of flesh. And in some ways, it's a backhanding compliment to women's cricket that people do feel comfortable now in saying, "Well, hold on, this has to change and that has to change." But for me, watching it, I was just marvelling at how far this Australian side have taken the game on. It was staggering.
But England aren't a bad side. They're still second or third in the world, and it's Perry and Lanning. They've got a lot of cricket ahead of them. The next few years, and with the likes of Gardner and Molyneux coming through, this Australia side is the best in the world by quite a long way, and seems to be getting better as well.
Well, this is it. I can't really see how England catch up Australia at this rate. There don't seem to be the young players coming through. There's loads of potential, but there's not the kind of the star names. We can't wait to see this person playing for England. I mean, the closest probably would have been Sophia Dunkley over the last
and
couple
she
of
wasn't
years.
Picked for the
and
T20s.
She hasn't played at all in this Ashes series. And not to be picked even for the T20s, I thought was really surprising. She's had a really good season in domestic cricket for Middlesex as well. So that I don't know the reasoning for that. I don't quite understand it. But it is a concern if the best young talent can't force themselves into a disappointing side who are out of form, then there are some pretty serious questions to answer.
Joe, what's your moment of the week?
Mine was here at the Oval last Thursday, the first T20 I've been to here this season. They're always exciting events, obviously quite beery events, but also lots of, every time I seem to watch T20 here, something amazing happens. And it was a fairly kind of pedestrian first innings from Surrey. I think they got 140. And I was with I brought a few friends along to watch from our office who don't really know their cricket. So I turned to them and said in my kind of sage way, "Well, that's, yeah, about 30 runs short here." And then obviously Glamorgan got bowled out for 44. My prediction was way, way off. But that chase featured Tom Curran taking a hat trick.
Proper test match style hat trick.
It was,
as well.
Yeah. Clean bowled the first, a couple of catches from Ricky Clark in the slips. And it's been a funny old couple of months for Tom Curran, who hadn't played a game for almost 2 months since the England warm-up games. Then it's part of this incredible game-changing thing for English cricket, but also on the fringes of the whole thing. So it must have been a kind of combined amazing position to be in, but also quite a frustrating one. And then he comes back and bowls against Essex and I think concedes 63 from three overs. So it was great to see Curran kind of back in the wickets, back doing what he does.
And he did turn up to work on one of them electronic scooters, though, this morning, which was very strange, I thought.
He's also got a wicket-taking celebration to rival Imran Tahir now, who's obviously here at Surrey as well. I think they're going to kind of do races across the Oval outfield to see who can go further than they've taken a wicket.
Elsewhere, Jofra Archer was involved in another tie in his comeback from injury for Sussex. He likes a tie at the moment. He took 2 for 21 from his four overs as Sussex tied with Surrey. Not a bad bowling attack at Sussex. They've got Rhys Topley, Jofra Archer, Tamal Mills, Rashid Khan, Danny Briggs and Chris Jordan, who isn't playing at the moment.
And they've also just brought in Alex Carey, right?
Yeah.
Who got runs.
Got to be overwhelming favourites for the blast.
Mills bowling rapid again as well, to the point where I'm wondering if he can keep doing that, he'll be on England's radar for the World T20.
Oh, 100%, 100%. Yeah. If he's fit, I think he's got to be in their plans. I think England didn't really pick him recently, A, through injury, but B, because they were kind of using the T20s to look at players they wanted to look at for the one days. And yeah, I think now the focus will shift back to T20s. I'd imagine he'd be picked in their squads going forward.
You'd think certainly a squad, wouldn't you? Yeah. Yeah.
Elsewhere in the T20 Blast, the Durham-Worcester game from the other day was an interesting one. Durham scored 181 from their 20 overs. A good effort, you take that. But Worcester chased it down in 12.1 overs for the loss of just one wicket. Martin Guptill scored an unbeaten 86 off just 31 balls. That's what he's going to be saying the rest of his career. Oh, yeah. Glad he's doing well. He's got over it. Big cricket news. Mohammad Amir's retired from Test cricket. He's just 27. Joe, why has he done that?
Well, to focus on white ball cricket.
That's the official line.
That's the official line. He seems to be about to, well, the suggestion is he's going to come over and live here, apply for a passport to come and live in England, which was the impression when you interviewed him a couple of years back. He just raved about how much he loved living in England. And,
yeah,
his
wife is English. She met him during his Southwark Crown Court case and had no idea who he was or what he was doing in that particular part of London. He credits her with having saved him, really. He loves it over here. They love him at Essex as well. James Foster said he's the most talented bowler he's ever kept to. He will probably, I imagine, have an eye on becoming an Essex institution over the next few years, I would have thought. And good luck to him. I like him. I like him as a character. I think he's great to watch on his day as well. I hope he has another 2 or 3 years for Pakistan. Bowling with the white ball, he was great in the World Cup. I don't question his decision on Test
match. Test cricket is probably his best format though.
Yeah, well, statistically it's not though, is it?
I think he is. No, his last 6 tests he averaged 21.
Is that right?
Yeah, he had a lean spell, but then he came back. He like in helpful conditions. The UAE's worst place to bowl as a fast bowler in world cricket. A lot of players better than Amir are going to struggle there, but you put him in conditions that are good for team bowling, he's brilliant, and there are very few in the world better than him.
Yeah, there's maybe not that many occasions though. I don't know what their itinerary's like for the next 2 years, you know, but there's maybe just not enough in there for him to hang around. I don't know.
I saw Ramiz Raja tweeting that, I mean, Pakistan cricket have stood by him, they've been patient with him, and now they need him desperately, really, that they need him to contribute and give something back. And I do see that argument to a certain extent. Although I do think Ramiz Raja said at the time that Mohammad Amir should never play for Pakistan ever again. So I'm not sure how those two things square up against each other.
Well, I think it's a major shame. I wouldn't be surprised if he played a test again. In fact, I think I'd be surprised if he never played a test again. He's only 27. In 4 years' time, he could have a rethink. Surely whenever Pakistan play in England, there'll be a temptation for him, for him to take more test wickets and be for Pakistan.
And U-turns in Pakistani cricket aren't unheard of, yeah. Are they?
Absolutely.
Anything else?
Yeah, we've got loads, actually.
Excellent.
Loads.
Let's fire through.
So the first test match of the Ashes at Edgbaston will mark the start of the inaugural World Test Championship.
Good.
It will see the top 9 test teams in the world, Australia, Bangladesh, England, India, New Zealand, Pakistan, South Africa, Sri Lanka and West Indies, compete in 71 tests across 27 series played over 2 years, with the top 2 teams contesting the ICC World Test Championship final in June 2021 to be played in the UK. What do you think about that?
I think it's great. I would just add... Well, I'd add 2 things, actually. One, it's unfortunate that there's not exactly the same number of games being played amongst the top teams. That is imbalanced.
The schedule's nuts.
Yeah, it is nuts. That is imbalanced, and that there will be quibbles and questions around it. But there aren't really quibbles and questions around who is the preeminent team at the moment, according to the world rankings. You know, India recognise that when they have their peculiar test mace ceremony, and England's March number 1 is the subject of a current film, right? So it has credibility in and of itself. And the other thing I would add is that why don't you make it a 3-test series, right? I get that the eyes of the world, in theory, I always have to put that in speech marks when it comes to cricket, but the eyes of the world will be watching that test match at Lord's in July or whenever it is in 4 years' time. But 2 years' time.
Two years' time.
But why not make it a 3-test series? Why not really build it out and then you legislate for a bit of rain? You legislate for getting skittled in a session and a half on a green one under leaden skies at Lords. Make it a three test series and then there can't be any quibbling, really.
My issue is where the final is played as well. I think home advantage is still so significant. And so the top two go and play a test match. Is it decided at Lords? Has that been confirmed? Yeah. Okay. Well, if England finish in the top two, say England finish second to India and they get to play India at Lords, that's not a very even way to finish it to me. I mean, I think...
But they will be sharing it around.
A three-test series would be great. I'd like each side has a home test, if that could be managed. But then, obviously, that becomes difficult with the calendar.
Well, exactly, and it would be difficult to play say it is England-Australia. When do you play that two-test series with enough currency and enough closeness of those two games?
So, as with all these things, it doesn't really work. But I don't think a one test match to decide this whole thing is enough.
No, I agree. I'm less concerned. I understand, obviously, home advantage is clear. But it will presumably be changing around every 2 years. So it will be in Australia next time, Sri Lanka the next time, India next time, and so on.
I don't think Sri Lanka will be getting one, perhaps.
No, but why not? I mean, you know, they've had staged World Cups before, so...
Talking of Sri Lanka and Bangladesh are contesting one of the most meaningless series you can imagine.
Well, I mean, philosophically, all of this is meaningless.
Yeah, but this is particularly meaningless. They're playing a three-match ODI series just after the World Cup. There's no tests, there's no T20Is, just this three-match ODI series. But on the plus side, Avishka Fernando batted like a dream again yesterday.
He
scored a 75 ball, 82, continuing where he left off in the World Cup. He's quite good. And finally, we'll end with Singapore.
Why didn't we go off with Singapore? Come on.
Next week we'll lead with Singapore. So Singapore finished top of the T20 World Cup Asia qualifier standings with Nepal, who were quite good, finishing in third place, which means that Singapore will go to the big qualifier in Dubai, where there are 14 teams, I think, playing, and they're vying for six spots at the World T20 World Cup, next year in Australia. Do you want to guess the 13 teams that have... Or 12 teams that have qualified so far for the...
No,
for the
it's been a long show already.
Well, so it's Scotland, Netherlands, Hong Kong, Oman, Ireland, UAE, Papua New Guinea, Kenya, Namibia, Jersey and Singapore.
I'm on the Jersey.
Yeah, it's been a long show today. Well done for getting the end if you have indeed got to the end. Phil and Joe, thanks so much for coming on.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Yaz.
We'll see you next week. If you haven't subscribed already, please do. See ya.